Well, thank you for the invitation to be with you again. I think it's become more or less a sort of annual summer visit, and it's always a joy, and I'm sure God will bless us together as we open his word. I think I've really drawn the short straw in being given these final chapters of Genesis and coming right at the end of your series on the Joseph story, because I've no idea what other people have already said, so it's a bit of a risk that I might repeat what you've already heard. I'm not going to deal with these chapters 48 to 50 in any detail. I'm going to focus on the verses that Neil read to us, but I do want to say a bit about chapter 48. In chapter 48, rather a strange thing happens, because Jacob calls for Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and in effect goes through a kind of adoption ritual. He makes those two sons of Joseph his own sons. They're to be counted among the sons of Jacob. We're not told why Jacob does this, but it's fairly clear why it's mentioned in the story, because it explains why these two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, become two of the ancestors of the 12 tribes of Israel, and why there isn't a tribal territory for Joseph later on. Instead of a tribal territory for Joseph, we have the tribal territories of Ephraim and Manasseh. So that's rather an odd little incident in chapter 48, but it does have these important historical repercussions, and I'm sure that's the reason that it's there. But even as Jacob looks forward to the future of these two tribes descended from Joseph's sons, he also looks back. It says that as he blessed them, he said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys." I think these are quite powerful words, and the reference to the angel who has redeemed me from all evil almost certainly refers back to Jacob's weird encounter with God in Genesis chapter 32. I'm sure you know the story. It's the night before Jacob is due to meet his brother Esau, after many, many years of separation. And a stranger appears and wrestles with Jacob all night. And it's during that encounter that Jacob is given the name Israel. And surprisingly, this new name is hardly used of Jacob until we get to the last three or four chapters of the book of Genesis. And here in chapter 48, Israel is actually used far more often than the name Jacob is used. Israel is used 8 times, and Jacob is only used twice. And I think that's a strong clue that here we're being referred back to the time when Jacob was given this new name. The angel who has redeemed me from all evil is, then, I suggest, a reference to the angel of the Lord, with whom Jacob believed he'd been wrestling, the angel of the Lord often being indistinguishable from God himself in Genesis. And it's because Jacob believes he's been wrestling with God himself that he says at the end of that strange wrestling match, he calls the spot Peniel, and which means face of God. And he says, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been spared." Now, Jacob, I'm sure, saw that incident as a turning point in his life, and that's why it's mentioned in the context of this blessing. So it's worth pausing a moment to ask what that encounter meant to Jacob. When it happened, he was, as I said, preparing to meet his brother Esau after many years of separation. And Jacob had fled from Esau because Esau wanted to kill Jacob because Jacob had stolen his birthright. And all these years later, Jacob still fears his brother Esau. He still suspects that Esau wants him dead. And so he's been preparing to pay Esau off with a gift, to win his favor with a gift of flocks and herds, in which Jacob has now become immensely rich. But when they eventually meet, it's nothing like the encounter that Jacob was expecting. Instead of Esau being an enemy who needs to be paid off, Esau runs up to him and embraces him and weeps and kisses him. And he won't accept any of the gifts that Jacob wants to offer. There are parallels here, which I'm sure you've noticed, with Jesus' story of the prodigal son, except instead of the reconciliation of son and father, it's the reconciliation of two brothers. And of course, in Jesus' parable, there are also two brothers, but they remain unreconciled. And it's been suggested, in fact, that this Old Testament story was at least part of the inspiration for Jesus' parable. But there's a very telling verse in this story of Jacob and Esau, and it's in Genesis 33, verse 10, where Jacob, after their reconciliation, Jacob says to Esau, "I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me." Now remember, when after Jacob's wrestling match, he calls the spot Peniel, which means face of God, saying, "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been spared." And when he's reconciled with Esau, he says, "I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me." So Jacob very explicitly compares his reconciliation with Esau with his earlier encounter with God. His encounter with God, then, was an overwhelming experience of being accepted. After a lifetime in which Jacob had been wheeling and dealing with God, which is a lifetime that he was forced to act out in a very physical way in that wrestling match, he discovered that God was for him, not against him. He discovered that God was for him, not against him. That blessings didn't have to be somehow wrenched out of God, but God was wanting to give them. Jacob was also, in that wrestling match, forced to speak his original name of Jacob. And Jacob means he grabs by the heel, or more briefly or simply, he cheats. So being forced to speak his name was like being forced to confess the kind of person that he'd been. The kind of person he'd been, both in relation to Esau, whose birthright he'd stolen, and in relation to God. The wrestling match was Jacob's moment of self-understanding, but also a deep moment of coming to understand what God was really like. And I'm sure that without that moment of revelation, Jacob would not have been able to speak in chapter 48 of the God who has been my shepherd all my life, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. And I suggest that we all need such a moment of revelation if we are to walk with God in the full knowledge of his love. As Jesus said, if you who are evil know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good things to those who ask him? If you don't feel you're there yet, then do pray that God will give you that revelation of his love for you, so that you don't feel you have to be constantly twisting God's arm to get those good gifts from him. And then in chapter 49, Jacob calls his other sons together and they all receive his blessing. Now I'm going to skip over chapter 49 fairly quickly. I just want to point out that these so-called blessings are really prophecies, because they are about the future, not of the individual sons, but the future of the tribes that are going to be descended from them and named after them. They predict, for example, that Judah is going to be preeminent, it's going to be the royal tribe, and that Simeon and Levi will not actually have their own tribal territories, each for different reasons. But we're not going to go into any of the details of these predictive blessings in chapter 49. After he's delivered these prophetic blessings, Jacob dies. And in accordance with his wishes, Joseph takes his body back to the land of Canaan, where it's buried in the family burial plot, which Abraham had bought many years before. And so we come to the passage which Neil read for us, chapter 50, verses 15 to the end of the book. So far, Joseph has been very kind to his brothers. They've had a degree of reconciliation already, and Joseph has treated them well. But now, with Jacob dead and buried, the brothers begin to worry. What if Joseph was only being kind to them for Jacob's sake? What if now, with Jacob out of the way, it's payback time? So they're afraid, and they go to him with this message, which they claim Jacob has told them to deliver, but whether that's the case, we don't know, which is asking for Joseph's forgiveness. And Joseph turns out, as we would expect, because we've read the rest of the story, turns out to be a superb example of how not to render evil for evil, but to answer evil with good. Let me just read again verse 18. I think it's 18 I'm talking about. His brothers came and fell down before him and said, Behold, we are your slaves. But Joseph said to them, Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? In other words, it's only God who deals out judgment and punishment. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people, or a populous people, should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. He sees his brothers bowing down before him, and I'm sure he realizes that this is a fulfillment of one of the dreams he had way back when he was a teenager, when he saw the sun and moon and stars bowing down, and he saw all the wheat sheaves bowing down to his. In those days, of course, he was rather arrogant about it, and told these dreams in ways that rather riled the rest of the family. Now he remembers the dream He remembers, I'm sure, his own behavior at the time, and he realizes that here is that dream being fulfilled. Here are all his brothers bowing down before him and saying, "We are your slaves." And in fact, a similar thing has happened in chapter 42, where the text specifically says that Joseph remembered the dreams he had dreamed of them. It's a golden opportunity for Joseph to say, "I told you so." But he doesn't. He doesn't say, "I told you so." In fact, instead, we're told that he wept. Joseph wept. In fact, this is the second time he's broken down in front of his brothers. The first time was in chapter 45, where he made the decision to reveal to them who he was, and where they had their first step of reconciliation as a family. He weeps. We don't know for sure what's going through Joseph's mind, but I suggest that in both these moments of breakdown, where Joseph weeps, he's experiencing the healing of the deep wounds of misunderstanding and rejection that marked his own past. And perhaps, to some extent, a level of repentance for his own arrogant behavior as a teenager. Either way, with forgiveness, the forgiveness that he gives them, there comes total reconciliation and healing. And this is Joseph's most valuable legacy. The family is fully reunited through this event. There is no reconciliation without forgiveness. There is no forgiveness, for most of us, without healing. And all three of those things come together at this moment of crisis. There's forgiveness because there's healing for the deep wounds of misunderstanding and rejection. And there's a reconciliation because there is forgiveness. And Joseph says, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about, that many people should be kept alive as they are this day." God intended it for good. Does Joseph mean that God intended his brothers to plot his murder, to throw him into a pit, to lie to their father about a wild animal having killed him? No, I don't think he means God intended that. I think his meaning is rather more subtle. The word that's translated here as intend, or sometimes devise or design, is a word that has a lot of different meanings in the Old Testament. When it's used as a noun, it's often translated as a designer or weaver or artist. It's a word that's used a number of times in Exodus 26 and 35 to describe the intricate design and craftsmanship that went into the tabernacle curtains. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Bristol Cathedral looking at an exhibition of some amazing panels that had been done by an artist called Sue Simmons, a local artist. And there were 50 panels, each about this high and about this wide, and each one represented a verse or a phrase from Genesis 1 and 2. So it's a series of panels reflecting and illustrating the theme of creation in the opening chapters of Genesis. And they were absolutely amazing. I went to see them because someone had recommended it to me, but I was quite bowled over. I wasn't expecting anything quite so beautiful. These 50 panels were a combination of painting, needlework, tapestry, an amazing combination of colors and textures. Extremely beautiful. And each panel was quite thick because all the threads at the back, I suppose, had been somehow bound together and covered up. And I wondered what the back of each panel would look like, if you could see it. I'm sure it would look like a fairly messy tangle of knots and loose ends of threads and colour coming through. Somewhere in one of C.S. Lewis's books, and I looked for this a couple of days ago but couldn't find it, he suggests that our lives are like, to us, are like the back of a tapestry. We can often only see the tangles, the knots, and the loose ends. And we can't make sense of that mess. But if we could see the design from God's perspective, we would see the other side and see the finished product in all its beauty and variety and richness. And there's something of that in what Joseph says here. I love the fact that this word for intend or design or devise is the same word that's used for an artist doing these intricate designs on the tabernacle curtains. From God's perspective, there was far more going on than could be seen in the messiness of what Joseph's brothers were doing to him. Does that mean, though, that God intends everything that happens? No, I don't think that's the biblical picture. The Bible represents many things being done which are not in line with God's will. And yet, God is able to use even those things and to take his will forward through them. God didn't want Israel to have a king, but Israel insisted on having a king, and God allowed it and went on to weave it so fully into his purposes that the Messiah was to come from the line of David. In my early days as a Christian, I used to think that God's plan for each of our lives was something like an engineer's blueprint. Any departure from the blueprint meant that something wouldn't work properly. Mistake God's will, and you'd be following an inferior path. You'd be stuck forever in plan B, which would not be as good as plan A. But it seems to me that the biblical picture is not that God is an engineer with a blueprint. God is an artist, a weaver, a craftsman. He doesn't have a single blueprint. He has many ways of achieving his purposes. God gives to each one of us an alarming amount of freedom, and somehow, in ways we will not understand in this life, somehow he weaves our choices, our right and our wrong choices, into his design. A former colleague of mine, David Runcorn, wrote a book a few years ago called Choice, Desire, and the Will of God. What more could you want? Choice, Desire, and the Will of God. What more could you want? And I recommend that book for anyone who wants to think this through in more depth of exactly how God is at work in our lives and how his purposes somehow hang together with the freedom he gives us and even the wrong choices that we may make. I don't mean to suggest that God will find ways to bless us whatever we do. It's clear, for example, that going back to Joseph, it's clear that Joseph, at least after arriving in Egypt, was a man of total integrity. He was faithful and responsible in all the different duties he was given. The irony of the story is that he suffered in spite of that. Indeed, God was with Joseph, we're told in Genesis 39, but that was no protection against betrayal and false accusations. The challenge of Joseph's example is to keep on doing the right thing, even when it brings no reward, but only disaster. I'm sure we've all heard people say, "Don't worry, I'm sure you'll be able to look back on this crisis and see that it was all for the best. I know people have said that to me, I'm sure they've said it to you, when you've been going through difficult times. It may be true, but it's not always a helpful thing to say. It never sounds remotely credible at the time. And if we're honest, some of the bad things which happen to us always seem pointless and futile, even many years later. Nevertheless, it remains true that God can bring good out of disaster and always longs to do so. I expect many of us could think of times when the mess has seemed irredeemable, and yet later on we've seen how God was able to use it. I can remember still many years ago at this time of year getting very disappointing A-level results and not being able to go forward in what I wanted to do. The upshot was I took my A-levels again a year later, and in that intervening year I had a complete change of direction. I wasn't even a Christian at that time, and yet I believe God was at work in my life, and that that change of direction was part of his will that led to me 2 years later becoming a Christian and being on a path which God has richly blessed ever since. And I expect many of us here could give that kind of testimony. I think there are two levels of application of this story. We modern Westerners, with our individualistic mindset, instinctively expect the Bible to speak to us as individuals. And I've just given you a testimony where I've applied it in an individual way. So I think we need reminding that this is primarily a story about God's people, for God's people as a people. It's about how God worked in adverse circumstances to fulfill his covenant promise to make for himself a people, the people Israel. As part of the Christian scriptures written for our learning, as Paul puts it, this story provides a mixture of challenge and assurance for the church on both the local and the global level. God has a purpose for his people on earth, which is that through them he will be glorified. And his purpose will not ultimately be thwarted. But at the same time, God's care does extend to each one of us individually. Even the hairs on your head are all numbered, says Jesus. And in that sense, it's right that we as individuals should hear both the challenge and the assurance of Joseph's story. What I'm saying is, please don't lose sight of the bigger picture of what God is doing with and for his people. Finally, a brief reflection on how the Joseph story anticipates the gospel. If we read the story carefully, there is a universal flavour to quite a lot of it. When Jacob first arrives in Egypt, he blesses Pharaoh. We're told in chapter 47 twice that Jacob blessed Pharaoh. We're not told what he said exactly, but he blessed Pharaoh. God's blessing extends to the ruler of this foreign nation, this nation which is to become, some while later, Israel's oppressor. Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are the sons of Joseph and an Egyptian wife, Asenath, daughter of an Egyptian priest. And yet they are adopted, as we've seen, by Jacob as his own sons and are later ranked among the ancestors of the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph says in these verses we've been just looking at that that God worked through all that his brothers did to him so that many people, or a numerous people, should be kept alive. In other words, God's plan was not just to preserve Jacob and his sons, but also to save the Egyptians. God's plan to save Egypt is something that's picked up again by the prophet Isaiah in chapter 19. The Lord will make himself known to the Egyptians. The Egyptians will know the Lord in that day. On that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, "Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel my inheritance." Of course, we still look to the ultimate, for the ultimate fulfillment of that promise, but it's a promise, we ought to remind ourselves, whose fulfillment began long ago. It's no coincidence that the Coptic church in Egypt and the Syrian church in the territories of ancient Assyria are among the oldest churches in existence. And finally, Joseph himself provides certain parallels with Jesus. I'm sure you've noticed. Rejected, thrown into a pit to die, later falsely accused and imprisoned. An innocent sufferer. A man who took the form of a slave, but was then raised to high status for the salvation of many. Oh, the depth and the riches and the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways, says St. Paul. Amen.